So when we think about how we can save energy and, you know, lower our carbon footprint, we often think, okay, we need to move to an electric vehicle, we need to ride our bike to work instead of take the car, use public transportation, get a heat pump.
Evan Helper is a business reporter at The Post covering the energy transition. He says there is a lot that is putting stress on the U.S.'s complex and aging energy grid. Extreme weather is the obvious culprit. But there's another more surprising way that America's energy grid is being tested, AI.
We don't often think about how we're using our laptops and the fact that, you know, if we just do a simple Google search, it's often powered by AI now. And that's going to take a lot more energy than the way we did a Google search before.
Just consider that for a second. Of all the ways our daily lives can impact the environment, how we use computers is a part of that too. Every time you ask ChatGPT to write song lyrics for your cousin's bar mitzvah, that has a real energy cost.
We're often not thinking about, is it actually going to really intensify my carbon footprint? And there's often, at the moment, not much you can do to mitigate that.
To power AI, tech companies have started building these data centers, massive warehouses full of computer servers. But these data centers require huge amounts of electricity. And in the communities where these data centers are being built, there's a lot of debate about where all this energy will come from and who should pay for it.
Right now, they consume about 3-4% of the electricity in the United States. By 2030, it's estimated it can be up to 9%, and it's going to keep going up. And just to give you an idea of how much one of these data centers, one of the bigger ones, might need in terms of power, you're talking about the amount of power of like tens of thousands of homes or a small city. So you're not talking about a small amount of power, and the amount that they need keeps increasing.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Wednesday, May 29th. Today, how AI has led to a surge in demand for cheap energy, and why this could be a make-or-break moment for the U.S. energy grid. So, Evan, we are headed into the summer, and for many people, things are about to get quite hot. This is a time of year when we're all running our ACs and our fans, and obviously people will need power to run those things. So what do we know about how the power grid in the U.S. is going to hold up as things get hotter and as we see demand rise this summer?
As we've seen in the last few years, we're in a precarious state. We've seen places that over the summer typically have had no problems with reliability, starting to have brownouts, starting to have these kind of rolling blackouts, where people lose their air conditioner for days at a time and, you know, it gets really hot. There's a number of reasons for that, but it looks like it's going to be another summer where large parts of the country could be unstable.
And how did this happen, or why is this happening? What is causing this surge in demand?
There's a number of reasons for it. First and foremost, the weather's changing, obviously. I mean, the fact that we're seeing high temperatures we've never seen before and these heat domes that go on for sustained periods of time. And it's not just that it gets hot in one place. It's just that it gets hot in large swaths of the country. So previously, what would happen is, you know, if one place was having a real heat emergency, they could look to a place nearby that could ship more power from the regional grid to help bail them out. But now if that place is also experiencing a heat emergency because these heat domes are so big and large, they can't bail out their neighbor. And so these shortages are happening. And so that we can attribute to the weather.
So that's one part of it, the weather. But also you have been reporting a lot on the role of tech in the demands that we're having on the power grid right now.
Yes. So the demands from the tech sector are just huge and getting bigger. And everyone saw this coming. We knew data centers were growing. The data centers are places that do a lot of the operations that we become accustomed to on the internet. They handle cloud storage, but more relevantly right now, they are where the artificial intelligence training centers are. And that's where they're training these AI models. And the training for the AI models takes just immense amounts of power. And it was always known that this was going to take a lot of power to sort of win this AI race that these American tech companies are set on winning, and also a lot of politicians and, you know, businesses are set on winning as well for a number of reasons. But it's moving so fast. I guess the AI technology, the innovations are progressing so quickly that we're just needing amounts of power that we didn't foresee needing this quickly. And so there's this race by these companies to find as much power they can as they can anywhere in the country. And it's kind of sending utilities into a panic. Mm-hmm. And I think these companies hadn't really expected, you know, that it would take this much electricity either, because a lot of these tech companies, you know, the Amazons, Microsoft, Google, Meta, they made major climate commitments. I mean, they are out front in sort of the energy transition and pushing to decarbonize the economy. But now they're in a place where, you know, it was easier when they were sort of software companies that were less energy intensive than like the manufacturing sector. But now they're in a place where, you know, they look more like cement plants or steel plants in terms of the amount of energy they need.
I just want to understand a little bit more. The data centers that you're describing, are these warehouses? I mean, I'm imagining like some scene in a sci-fi movie where like the people bust into the place where they house the data, and it's like rows and rows of machines. And like, what are these places that we're talking about that are sucking up so much energy? And what is the scale of these kinds of facilities and the infrastructure that is being powered?
Yeah, you've got it right. If you were to walk inside one of these data centers, it would look exactly like what you saw in the movies, with just sort of rows and rows of racks and servers and just computer equipment, not a lot of people, just computers running and doing operations in these large warehouse-like structures. Mm-hmm. And they're getting bigger and bigger as they consume more energy.
And when we talk about these data centers, where in the country are we seeing more of these huge data centers popping up?
So traditionally, the data centers were located in areas where all the internet infrastructure is. So they, you know, the hubs were Northern Virginia, Silicon Valley. But now the issue is power. And so there's limited power left in those places. And so the data centers started moving out to all places in the country we never associated with data centers before. They started moving to Texas, where there's a lot of power cheap. But then they started to move places like, you know, Altoona, Iowa, where they're just, for one reason or another, the power grid had a lot of energy available, you know, and some big tech companies moved out there, and then all the data centers moved out to that area. Georgia, you know, they really courted data centers, and now there's a whole bunch of them there, so much so that they're really concerned about running out of power. Omaha, Nebraska, a place, you know, that was not really a tech hub, but they had a lot of power available. So they're basically now locating in places all over the country where they can find power, you know, and where it's readily available. But those places are getting fewer and further in between.
And so in the places where these data centers exist and the demand for energy is so high, and the grid seems especially taxed, like, what has it been like for people there? How are these communities dealing with, okay, we have this big data center that's powering the internet, and maybe that's great. Maybe that's like providing jobs or whatever, but it's also a big suck on the energy that this community needs.
It's become a huge source of community tension in places throughout the country. You know, in some places, you've seen lawmakers really push hard to bring these data centers in because they like the tax revenue they bring. I mean, you're talking about these big, expensive operations that don't use up much in the way of community resources like schools and other services, because they're not bringing a lot of people. They're just sort of building these big, expensive buildings and not bringing a lot of employees in them. And so you've seen some communities that, you know, provided all kinds of tax breaks because they loved the idea of these data centers coming in. They saw revenue, and they also sort of liked the idea of being a high-tech hub. But now some of those places, Georgia, you know, most notably, are getting very nervous about the amount of power that these data centers are sucking up, and concerned about what that means for other ratepayers in the area. The tech companies say, we pay our own way, we fund the infrastructure, but it's really not that simple. When you fund infrastructure for a utility or need to bring more electricity into an area, there's all kinds of factors that go into it, and there's no real way right now that someone can just say, okay, I'm going to pay my own way, and I'll bring in all this electricity, and I will fund all the infrastructure for it. It generally falls, some of it at least, onto ratepayers. And there's a lot of concern that ratepayers are shouldering the cost for these industrial centers that they're not getting benefit from.
So it sounds like this is bringing up a lot of concerns for the people who live in the communities where these data centers are located. But also, you've reported on how this has created some tension between communities or between states. One example you had is between Virginia and Maryland about a data center and who is going to pay to power that data center. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Northern Virginia is still... a lot of elected leaders there are all in on data centers. They see this as a major hub of the economy. And so they want the data centers to keep coming, but that means they need to bring in a lot more power. And so there's a $5.2 billion power project that Dominion Energy wants to bring more power basically for these data centers. And the infrastructure to build that and to bring all the power through, some of it needs to come through Maryland. And Maryland ratepayers are looking at this, and the ratepayer advocate in Maryland said, you know, we don't benefit from this at all. Virginia made a policy choice to bring in all these data centers. We're going to have to pay for this infrastructure to sort of shore up the power grid so it can bring more energy down to Northern Virginia. And what are, you know, Maryland residents getting out of it? Arguably not much, but they're going to have to see a rate hike because of it. And so they're protesting that.
I think what I find so compelling about that one example, this beef between Maryland and Virginia, is it speaks to what makes the grid so complicated, right? Is that it's not just like one community by itself with its own power. It's like we get power from other places. It's transmitted across the country, oftentimes across state lines, and that it's kind of a messy system. Can you talk about why the power grid right now across the country like can't handle this new demand for powering these data centers? And like, I think a lot of folks would say, well, if we need more power, like we should just be building stuff to make more power and to transmit more power. What's the problem here?
So that tension between Virginia and Maryland really does illuminate a much bigger and broader problem with the power grid. So to fix the power grid right now and make it ready for all the renewable energy that's coming online, and a lot is and a lot successfully been brought online, obviously, but to really meet all the demand that's coming in the next few years, there needs to be a lot more building of big solar farms, big wind farms, more geothermal, maybe some more nuclear will come online. And these big generating centers are often not exactly where the power is needed. You know, the power is often needed in urban centers where there's no room to build, you know, a wind farm. And so you need those power lines often to go across state lines to bring on all this renewable energy or really any energy. And there's a lot of disputes between states, especially as things become more polarized. And, you know, you may have like in California, they want all kinds of renewable energy. They have, a mandate to decarbonize their grid, but the power lines need to go through other Western states to bring more wind energy to California. And some of those Western states may be really big on fossil energy. You know, they have a coal industry. They're doing fracking. They don't really buy into wanting to just totally decarbonize the grid and move past all this fossil energy. And they're saying, wait a minute, why do we need to have these power lines not only paid for, but going over the property of our landowners who don't want them so we can help California meet its renewable energy goals? So there's all these tensions, and the federal government has very little authority to broker them and basically tell one state you have to do this. And, you know, it's up to the states, and the states can't agree on what they want to do.
So even in places where they have made a commitment to clean energy, there are questions around, like, how much is that commitment realistic when it's, like, either to get the clean energy from somewhere else or to send their clean energy elsewhere. In some cases, seems like it's not totally possible considering the state of the actual electricity infrastructure.
Yeah. So the Biden administration has a goal to have the power grid completely decarbonized and emissions free, or, you know, net zero emission, erase all the emissions on the power grid by 2035. With all this demand that's coming from these data centers and other needs that are emerging, and all of these kind of tensions around building high voltage transmission lines, that goal is looking further and further out of reach. And beyond that, there's just all kinds of rules around when, you know, who has authority to fix what and when you can sue if you don't want to see a project go through your land.
Though when we talk about the concerns that communities have about building this kind of new infrastructure, I mean, I think it's easy to paint it as like, oh, these people are just whining about, you know, playing their role in this thing that everyone needs and is going to make, you know, our grid stronger and more capable for the future. But I mean, some of these are very real concerns, especially about like where they put this infrastructure and the kinds of communities that end up being targeted often when people want to like build ugly but important things that don't really enhance quality of life in a particular place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that's a very big issue. So there's a lot of words that make this sound not that harmful. When we talk about moving these projects faster, we talk about fast tracking or permitting reform. But what it really means to do those things is you're sort of limiting people's rights in being able to contest these projects. And a lot of these projects go through neighborhoods that are traditionally disadvantaged, that are low income, that are Black and brown. And the Biden administration has prioritized helping those communities and making sure that they're no longer just considered sacrifice zones where we can put all the infrastructure that other people don't want to look at. And so there's a real tension there in terms of the need to get these projects built and protecting the rights of people who live in spaces that would be impacted by this infrastructure. And that is one of the things that is slowing down building out and shoring up the grid.
After the break, how tech companies and local governments are scrambling to find solutions. We'll be right back.
Hey there, I'm Michael Shearer. I hate to tell you, but there's a blizzard coming your way. Candidates and their allies are projected to spend more than $10 billion on political advertising this election season. My job as a national political reporter at the Washington Post is to bring you the real story of what is going on behind that wall of political noise. Presidential elections are fantastically messy endeavors, a chance for Americans to figure out once again who we are and who we want to be. And the only way to do that well is for citizens to know what is really going on. This is the kind of work you support when you become a subscriber to The Washington Post. Right now, you can get full access to the best reporters in America for 99 cents every 4 weeks for an entire year. If you've thought about subscribing for a while, this is the time to finally sign up. Go to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. That's washingtonpost.com/subscribe.
So I want to talk more about solutions. You mentioned the idea of high voltage transmission lines, which I find really interesting. Our colleague Shannon Osaka, she wrote a story recently about how this is considered like a potential big fix for the grid, that you could just replace the wires in our existing power lines to like let them flow more electricity through them. Can you explain exactly how that works and why this is a potential like pretty big upgrade for our system?
So what that's called is a grid-enhancing technology. There's a bunch of them out there, and the White House is very big on pushing utilities to put these new grid-enhancing technologies like these reconductoring, they call it, the power lines, so that they can carry more electricity and you could make the grid much more efficient without having to build all kinds of new power lines. It's low-hanging fruit, and utilities have not moved forward on some of these things, even though it seems obvious because of the way the whole structure is for paying for upgrades to the grid. And sometimes it's, you know, frankly, just more financially beneficial for a utility to build more infrastructure than fix the infrastructure they have, because the rules are such that they can make a more of a profit if they, if they build something new.
But then at the same time, it takes them like a million years to build the new thing, right? That it's not exactly like the, you know, power companies are building all this new stuff with any particular speed.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But in often cases, utilities are, they're owned by shareholders and they're looking to make profits. And the utilities are looking at, okay, if we do these grid-enhancing technologies, what's in it for us? This may actually not even help us bring more power to our customers and sell more energy. It may have to do with, you know, being able to ship more power somewhere else in the grid where we don't make money. It's a big investment for us. And so, like any other business, they look at the bottom line. I should say, though, that with the amount of energy that we are forecasted to need in just the next few years, the grid-enhancing technologies are the obvious place to start. They don't fix the problem. We need to build, like, thousands of miles of high-voltage transmission lines, and every year we're building fewer and fewer miles of that because it's just so hard to get anything built.
Hmm. So are there any other potential solutions here that could at least help the grid kind of meet the increased demand that we're seeing?
There are all kinds of potential solutions being talked about. The issue is, can these solutions be implemented without creating more of a climate problem? I mean, obviously, you use more energy, you have to worry about emissions. The best way to use more energy is to use more wind and solar energy. And these tech companies had always thought, well, we'll just power our way into the future by, you know, investing big in renewable energy. We are running out of renewable energy capacity because the grid can't handle bringing on all the renewable energy that we want to bring on. You know, it needs to be updated. And for all the reasons we've been talking about, it's not getting updated quickly enough. So what is happening is a lot of these companies are looking to other alternatives that can just get them the power they need. They're calling them bridge technologies. But the question is, are they really bridge technologies, or do you build, you know, this infrastructure that could create emissions and it gets locked in for, you know, 30, 40 years? So,
and when you describe that, like, what do you mean? What are those bridge technologies that companies are thinking about using that they think can, like, power them in the short term?
So the most obvious one is natural gas, right? And that's not a new technology. You know, we've been running a power system on gas for years and years. But suddenly, at a time we're supposed to be moving away from gas plants and moving away from all the emissions that gas comes with, we're seeing this boom in interest in just building more gas plants everywhere. So these utilities, as they're running out of energy and seeing they can't bring enough renewable energy on or can't afford to bring it on or that the power grid can't handle bringing it on, they're now turning to just these natural gas plants, which are much easier on the grid to bring online. So if you have a coal plant that's retiring, for example, you can put a natural gas plant in there, and it's a much more seamless transition than trying to locate a, you know, wind or solar farm, which has to have all the right, you know, geographic and weather conditions, and also operate differently because, you know, obviously the sun's shining certain times a day or the wind's blowing certain times a day, unlike a coal plant, which is going 24/7, and a gas plant does too. So huge gas boom we're seeing, and some data centers are looking at just kind of skipping the grid altogether and seeing if they can bring natural gas into their data centers and have little power plants on site to power those data centers. Another technology there's a lot of interest in, but honestly is not available yet, is small nuclear plants. The idea is to kind of shrink the footprint of a nuclear plant and turn it into what's called a small modular reactor. And again, that's something that could operate right on the property of a data center. But, you know, we don't build nuclear plants in this country anymore because there's so many challenges, just like fixing the grid, to building them.
Everyone's imagining, like, the Chernobyl scenario. I think it makes a lot of people nervous. But you're saying that there is at least an interest from some of these tech companies of, like, well, maybe we could build our own, like, teeny nuclear center that could just power us and it would be fine.
Yeah, more than an interest. They're investing hundreds of millions of dollars in these nuclear company startups that are trying to develop small footprints for these small nuclear plants. And, you know, the marketing says, well, this is safer. It's small. It's not like a giant, you know, it's not a 3 mile island size nuclear plant and no one needs to worry about safety. But, you know, it's a nuclear plant. And anytime you're dealing with anything nuclear, you've got nuclear waste, you've got all these issues. And, you know, they've been trying to have these pilot programs to get these small nuclear plants, some demonstration projects up and running. And frankly, they're just not going well because the cost, like has always happened with nuclear, the expectation is we'll bring in lots of cheap energy and this will be easy to do. And there's just cost overruns and it gets significantly more expensive than just using something like natural gas.
I also want to talk about one other solution that I've heard tossed around, this idea that maybe we can change the way that we use energy, both for data centers, but also for the stuff that, you know, we use to power our homes or our AC, and that we can, you know, is there a world where we can kind of move around when we're taxing the grid, when we're like using the most electricity in the day so that we're not all like turning on our stuff in the same few hours of the day every day. Can you describe a little bit of what the thinking is there and how much that is actually in the cards?
Yeah, so obviously the way we use energy and trying to be more efficient is a big piece of this, and it's a piece that's not discussed enough. I think often when it comes to energy and it comes to technology, there's this assumption that we can just innovate our way out of this. You know, there's always a technological solution that doesn't require us to change the way we live and what we do. And, you know, you're seeing that with AI right now. We're all using it and not even really even thinking about its impact on the environment. There are a lot of sort of efforts to at least make people aware and make people understand, like when you're doing a search, where the energy may be coming from. If you're using AI, is this coming from a nuclear plant or is your energy coming from, you know, a gas plant? Those things are hard to really kind of sift out and identify. But, you know, that's one piece of this. I mean, obviously, another piece of this is the tech companies are talking about ways in which they can help their usage and the flow of electricity sort of work in rhythm with when, you know, it's most available. But it's hard because these training models, these cloud centers, the internet, these are things that need to be operating 24/7. It's hard to just shut these things off or, you know, for them to power down somewhat. So, you know, there's not a lot of options in efficiency if what you're really trying to do is have these machines run at full bore so that we can make sure China doesn't beat us in, you know, the race to innovate AI.
So, Evan, you don't sound particularly optimistic about the idea that, like, any big fix that is going to save our power grid is on the horizon. What does that mean, then? Like, what is it going to mean for the near-term future if we continue to see, you know, the power grid overtaxed and us using more energy in part because of these data centers and a bunch of other things? And if, like, no kind of big aggressive moves are made to fix this problem?
A few things could happen. I mean, one is that the power system as we know it could change drastically. So I was talking before about how some companies are looking at just bringing the energy right to their, you know, their data center and just bypassing the grid altogether. Some companies are also trying to look into these advanced geothermal techniques where you really drill like 10,000 feet underground to where, you know, it's really hot and you can generate a lot of energy that way. And again, you don't need to be attached to the grid to use that kind of energy and power a data center that way. But if these big companies, which are projected to use, you know, as much as 9% of all the electricity consumed in the U.S. by 2030, go off the grid, that has all kinds of implications also. You know, we need investment in the grid. We need the big energy users to be investing in it. And if they sort of go off on their own, you know, then the rest of us need to pay even more for those upgrades that are still going to be necessary, you know, even if we don't need as much energy. I mean, the other thing is there just may not be enough to go around. And at a certain point, I mean, people are starting to have this discussion, you know, it's almost like saying the quiet part out loud, like, do we need to prioritize who gets what energy? So right now, Bitcoin mining, which some people would argue, you know, is that really doing a whole bunch of good for society? Who is it really helping?
That's a good question.
Yeah, and it takes a huge amount of energy, you know, and the question is, when there's limited energy, particularly clean energy available, should it be going to these Bitcoin miners? Or should they have to get to the back of the line? And so once you start to talk about that, people get very nervous. They say this is like socialism. We don't do that in this country. We don't, you know, tell businesses you can have power, you can't have power. We
but
never
have. It
sounds
have. Like that's going to be the reality anyways. Like that's where we're going as a world in which, you know, this country is facing widespread brownouts or parts of the day where some or all of us like can't use the power that we want to be able to use because it's simply not there.
It's hard to see how it doesn't get there. Although when you raise it in a conversation, you know, with like politicians who are involved in energy issues, they just, you know, they bristle because the idea that you would tell an industry, you know, you can't do this, it's just anathema to the way we operate in the U.S. It's, I mean, look at how hard it is to do the transition to electric cars. You know, you want to tell people, okay, you need to stop driving a gas vehicle. And people are just not having it. You know, they want to drive their gas vehicle as long as they want to drive it. And so this is even more complicated than, you know, the EV revolution.
Evan, thank you so much for explaining all of this.
Thank you for your excellent questions.
Evan Halper is a business reporter covering the energy transition for The Post. In my conversation with Evan, you heard us talk about the impact of extreme weather. And unfortunately, we are seeing some of that extreme weather taking hold in Mexico. The country is dealing with a prolonged and deadly heat wave, one of the most extreme that Mexico has ever faced. Many Mexican states have observed their highest temperatures on record. More than 80% of the country is also suffering from drought. In Mexico City, there's a growing fear that the city may run out of water. The heat is so bad that howler monkeys are falling out of trees dead. According to the Associated Press, the Mexican government has reported more than 150 heat-related howler monkey fatalities. And one more story that we're keeping an eye on. After closing arguments yesterday, jury deliberations began today in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York. The 12 jurors will need to agree unanimously on each of the 34 felony counts facing Trump. A verdict could come down later this week. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. You have probably been hearing my colleagues and I talk about subscriptions and about why you should subscribe to The Washington Post. It really helps us, it is valuable for you, and it could be a meaningful gift for someone else in your life. Right now, you can get a subscription to The Post for just 99 cents every 4 weeks. And you can give a full year as a gift for just $9.99. Go to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. It's a great deal, and it's only happening for a few more days. Today's show was produced by Renny Svernovsky. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Peter Bresnan with help from Monica Campbell. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.